on this yesterday. I'm joined by phone by Dr. Nick Flynn. Nick, good morning.
Good morning.
Just to pick up on the events of yesterday, disappointing?
Very disappointing, Neil, but what we're dealing with is human nature. Like since Adam and Eve, we've been making mistakes, and these are significant mistakes. But it's not just, I mean, the people who were trying to exercise yesterday and maybe inadvertently ended up in crowded areas. Look, it's a mistake made, but we need to dust ourselves down now and move on and not make it again. Like, we've also had situations over the weekend or just before the weekend where the Gardaí were finding that some pubs were still open and serving customers. Like, I mean, these are significant errors. Like we said last week, that doctors and nurses and pharmacists and all the healthcare professionals in the system, we can treat the sick. The only people who can stop the spread and decrease the number of people getting sick are the public themselves by taking the advice that they're given. But in a way, Neil, I'd compare it to if you were leaving a burning house. So if you're in a burning house and you made a mistake, you wouldn't dwell on the mistake. You would just find the next way out and you'd get out.
No, but I know that. And like, okay, people can be forgiven. They thought maybe there wouldn't be as many people and they got caught up in it. Firstly, they could have left. And secondly,
absolutely,
are they not listening to messages at all in the first place?
No, it's not, I agree with you, Neil. It's not good enough. Like, the decisions we make, and for sure, there will have been spread in those situations yesterday. Some of those people will infect more people. Some of the people along that chain will get sick. Some of those people will end up in hospital, and some of those people will end up in ICU. So these are very serious decisions that are being made by the public, and we need to like, the businesses have made such harsh decisions, have closed down. So pubs, restaurants, retailers have closed down. People are losing their jobs. Healthcare workers are going to work, putting their own health at risk. Like, how hard is it for other people just to stay at home and observe social distancing? It's almost unbelievable, Neil.
Okay, talk to me so about testing. I know Páirc Uí Chaoimh is now being rolled out and they should get 1,000 a day through it. But there are 40,000 waiting for tests. How long, firstly, does it take before you get a test, and how long does it take before you get a result?
Okay, so as you rightly said there, we have 40,000 people waiting nationally for tests, and 6,000 of those are waiting in Cork. Okay, so 6,000 people locally waiting for tests. It's currently, in my experience, taking 5 or 6 days from the point where I ask for a test till it's been done, and you can add another 2 days onto that for the result. So we're at over a week from request to result.
Now, RTE said this morning that people are waiting 5 to 7 days for a result.
That my experience would be it would be the outer side of that, Neil. So that we're 5 to 6 days to a test, and that we're another day or two for a result. So I would say we're at the longer edge of that for actual results is my experience at the moment. Now, I think it will improve, but I just want.
So we could be 10 days then from asking for a test to getting a result.
I think 10 days will be outside of it, but certainly we're at seven. We're at 7 days from asking the test to getting the result. Absolutely, and the significance of that, Neil, is that look, the 40,000 people have been told. So when you contact your GP, like your GP will take your symptoms, and so that people know, right? It's if you have any fever or any respiratory symptom, no matter how mild, don't be saying to yourself, oh, this is just a cold. Contact your GP. It's our job to decide if you meet the criteria for testing, and it's our job to refer as many people as possible to testing, notwithstanding the delays. So we'll do an online referral, as we discussed. There's some delays with that. Public Health have their process for arranging the test. The test goes to the lab, and then we get the result back to the patient. But it's important, Neil, that everybody who has a new onset fever or respiratory symptom still checks in with their doctor, and that referral is still done. The testing capacity within the system is being increased today. Apparently, Páirc Uí Chaoimh, when it's up and running in a day or two's time, will be testing 1,000 people a day, and we will have to do that and more if we're going to stop the spread of the coronavirus or COVID-19. Mike Ryan, who's an Irish man working with the WHO, said succinctly, we have to take the battle to the virus. We have to find out where the virus is in the community. We have to isolate if the cases for the virus is identified, and isolate their contacts. And that's where we're missing out at the moment. So we're missing out on contact tracing from those 40,000 people. And you can be sure, you can be absolutely sure, that the crowds of people we saw around at the weekend all over the country, that some of those people are contacts of people waiting testing, who, if testing was up to speed, would be told to self-isolate. So look,
so yesterday's carry-on will lead to a spike then?
Well, it was every decision we make that isn't prudent, every decision we make that doesn't involve social isolation, every social distancing, I beg your pardon, and every decision we make that isn't by the guidelines for washing our hands and decreasing the spread of this virus will result down the line on a population level of increased cases, which will be increased illness, which will be increased hospital attendance at some stage. So that's why we need to get this right. Like, if you look at the number of cases that we have, Neil, look, we've over 900 of cases of COVID-19 in the country at the moment. There's as we just discussed, there's a lag in testing, so they're actually historical figures, they're figures from last week, but the current figures that people can keep an eye on are the number of people in hospital. So we've 177 people in hospital with COVID-19, and that's what people, I'd encourage people to keep an eye on those figures, and 29 people in ICUs around the country. That was as of yesterday. That the figure for ICUs was 17, I think, on Friday. So an increase of...
They're critical then?
Yeah, an increase of over 50% in 2 days. So we currently, as of yesterday, had 29 people receiving intensive care for COVID-19 in the country.
Okay, so if you look at the 40,000, you take 4% of that, that's 1,600 people who probably have COVID-19 that we could statistically add to the 900 now at this stage.
Yeah, you could. I mean, I think certainly that we'll be looking at, we'll be in the thousands by next weekend, for the 4,000 or 5,000. I think depends on how much testing gets done. That's exactly what the HSE and the Department of Health have been telling us, that this curve will, like everywhere else, will rise exponentially, you know. And again, Neil, look, what's coming next? I mean, what's coming next is more testing. We discussed that. And not this week, but probably next week, the HSE announced yesterday that they will be opening what they call community COVID hubs. So this is basically, the Chinese did this as well, very effective way of assessing and deciding how sick people with COVID are in the community, and the Chinese called them fever clinics. So for people who are unwell with COVID in the community, before they go to hospital, they'll have the opportunity to be assessed in a COVID hub. So that's coming. But also, Neil, I think if you look at what happened at the weekend, if that continues, there are certainly more stringent social restriction measures.
Well, Harris said that this morning, that because of what they saw at the weekend, there probably will be an update of restrictions from the HSE from tomorrow. Can you just explain to me, at the moment, is it all drive-through? Like, what happens if you don't drive a car? How do you get to Páirc Uí Chaoimh?
So like, for this to be scalable, for this to work on large scale, people have to go to the test centres. So I'd ask people that when you are referred for a test, that one, you observe the self-isolation advice, that you don't mix with other people, and two, that when it comes your turn for the test, that you go to the test centre. But of course, there will be people in nursing homes, of course there will be elderly people
who don't drive,
and in those situations, the National Ambulance Service are still carrying out home testing. But to be fair to that service, because that is a limited capacity service, we need to, where possible, get people to the centres. And you and I know, Neil, that some people won't go because they just won't be motivated enough to go. Let's leave it at that. But we really need everybody to play their part now and to reserve the National Ambulance Service testing for those who definitely don't need it.
I hear that the A&E was never quieter. That's ironic, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. I think that, look, when we look back on this and when we look into the future, Neil, I think medicine will have changed.
Okay.
And that might be for lots of reasons. But also, Neil, that we've got 25%, they said 25% of hospital beds in the country are free. So not alone do we not have trolleys in A&E, we also have 25% free beds. So look, there's been a change in practice. All non-urgent or non-critical care has been postponed to free up capacity for sick people coming in.
No, I was probably making more of a reference to people who probably shouldn't have been in the past going to A&E in the first place. We're not seeing them going there now, you know what I mean?
I agree with you. I'm not seeing that on all tiers of the health service.
I have questions for you here, if you're interested in some of them from our good listeners. Firstly, one that keeps coming up over and over and over again, if you get COVID-19 or the coronavirus once, and you go through it and you self-isolate, you come out and say, can you get it again?
So we're still learning all the time about COVID-19. It is likely that most people will develop immunity, but that would come with a caveat that we have seen that for people get it and recover and get it again quickly, that it can cause an immune response in the system that causes people to be very unwell. So secondary infections are possible. But the whole premise, like the UK's whole premise, is based on herd immunity and people developing immunity to it. And it is something that is likely to happen. To happen, and it's likely that when, as a community, we get out the other side of this, we will have some immunity to COVID-19. But
if I get it and I go through the process of self-isolation and I have a mild dose of it, can I then go about my business immune?
Once your swabs are clear, the advice is that you will be able to, and you will have some immunity, yeah.
Okay. Are dentists still open, do you know?
As far as I'm aware, dentists have closed. I mean, again, my perception would be that dentists will have a high risk, will be a high risk procedure. You know, their drills are what they call aerosol generating. So if there is COVID-19, and COVID-19 is particularly concentrated, or it's in high volumes of the virus in the nasopharynx, the back of the nose, and the oropharynx, the back of the mouth.
So they should be closed if they're not then.
So it would be a high. I would perceive it as being a high risk procedure. I think the advice has been for them to close.
So what if people do? What do people do if they have raging toothache?
I presume that they'll be closed for bar emergencies, Neil, so I think they'll have to contact their dentist in that regard, yeah.
Okay.
A lot of dentistry, Neil, is not urgent, do you know, so I see the majority of it can wait until we see where this is going.
Why am I getting a lot of texts then and contacts from people who are being charged €40 or whatever for a phone call with their GP? Is that right?
Yeah, so I suppose the story is there that so you've got the medical card system and you've got the patients who don't have a medical card. A medical card would include doctor visit cards, okay? So the HSE have introduced, in fairness, a very generous payment for private patients who have COVID-19 queries or symptoms, that the GP can get paid €30 for a telephone consultation with those patients. But the HSE haven't introduced funding for private patients for other illnesses, for prescriptions and prescription assessments and prescription reviews. So the private patients the HSE haven't provided funding beyond the COVID assessment for them. So GPs are still charging for telephone assessments, and all non-urgent care will move to telephone and online assessment.
No, I don't quite follow that. I thought that the government now pay GPs, is it €30 or €40, something like that, for every COVID query they get from a patient or a client or a customer?
Not from a private patient. Yeah, so they pay it once for a private patient for the assessment and once for a private patient for relaying the result to them. But that's it. They don't pay, like, so if you've got a private patient who has got a query about the repeat prescription being issued, or who's got a query about arthritis.
No, I'm talking about COVID calls. People calling the doctor saying, "I have these symptoms, blah blah blah. I have fever, fatigue. I have a repetitive cough."
I can be very clear, Neil, that the government have funded two calls to your doctor for a private patient, and they haven't funded any more than that.
Okay. So what people need to be aware of then are the symptoms, right? Otherwise you're going to have people, because there will be other sicknesses and illnesses at this time of the year. And there's confusion then over, actually being worried about something that maybe you'd normally have at this time of the year anyway, and it being COVID-19. So what should people be looking out for in the early stages?
Okay, well, the kernel symptoms are fever, cough, shortness of breath. There are reports over the weekend that loss of smell and loss of taste seem to be a symptom in some people. But what I'd say to people is that really, for this phase of the public health measure to be successful, what we need is we need patients with any respiratory symptom to contact us so we can facilitate testing for them. So, and that's very important. And that's why the government have funded that payment for private patients, is so that people aren't sitting at home with a mild cough saying, "I'm not that sick," because patient with a mild cough can still have COVID-19, can still be spreading the virus. So we need to identify them, we need to isolate them, we need to identify their contacts and isolate their contacts. And this is not something that anybody should be afraid of. This is something that people should welcome and embrace, because it's by contact, it's by identifying cases and identifying contacts and isolating the lot of them that we will stop the spread or decrease the spread of this virus. So the message really for people is, look, you need to, with any respiratory symptom, don't even try and Google it, or don't even try and figure it out yourself. Contact your doctor, let us talk to you. We'll be able to try it if you're sick or not, so how sick you are, and we'll be able to get you testing. And that's what we need to do for everybody. Notwithstanding the delays that we're seeing, we still, our job, the public's job, is to follow the public health advice around personal hygiene, about social distancing, and contacting the doctor if they're sick.
I get that. There's been a run on thermometers, hasn't there? Because that's, but like, what's the thermometer reading danger sign? 39 point something?
No, we want to hear from anybody with a temperature over 37.5. It's a very low bar, because we don't want to miss anybody. This is really about identifying anybody.
I thought it was higher than that. Like, sure, you'll only get somebody who's kind of got some kind of a winter bug then as well, won't you?
No, Neil, I'll go back to again. We want to hear from everybody who is sick, everybody who even has a small chance of having COVID-19, and we want to get them tested. That's what this phase of the process is about. This phase is about testing, and again, I'll go back to it. We ask people, please, to contact us if you've got respiratory symptoms or any temperature, we'll try it over the phone and we'll arrange testing.
A respiratory, what do you call it? Respiratory what?
Symptom.
Symptom is shortness of breath in layman's terms, is it?
Or cough, any cough. I mean, or something, you can get a dry cough, you can get a productive cough. So if you're worried about any respiratory symptom, please contact your doctor.
Yeah, because so we'll be looking so for temperature, cough, sneezing, I heard, runny nose, shortness of
sore
breath,
sore
throat, yeah. Headache?
Again, headache, we're becoming a little bit more non-specific, but yeah, I mean, headache, patients who have COVID will have headache.
I want to bring in Dr. Paul O'Brien, if you don't mind, UCC genetics graduate, who feels, I think, among other things, that we need to get more serious about stricter social restrictions. Paul, good morning.
Hi, Neil. I'd just like to say, actually, I'm a medical doctor as well, rather than being a UCC.
Good man yourself. I've been following you on the media for the last couple of weeks, and you know your stuff. So in fairness to you, thank you for taking my call. Are you worried at all, say, for instance, about this Italian spike? 1,444 deaths over the weekend. It seems to be getting worse there, not better. Why?
I think it's pretty obvious that their healthcare capacities have been overrun. You know, there's a lag phase initially, and I think that kind of lulls people into kind of a sense of complacency. But as I think people have alluded to, it's like a tsunami. You're seeing it come towards you, and then it hits, and it just kind of gets worse and worse. As we've been using the phrase, there's exponential growth. So you're seeing doubling of the number over time. And as once capacities are stretched beyond, you know, their ability, then that's when you start to see the high mortality rate.
You're the genetics expert. Is it because the Italian population is quite elderly?
Again, I wouldn't position myself as a genetics expert, but I think the evidence is pointing that it's actually family clustering that would cause most of the mortality. Basically, in the initial phase, I think the Italians were probably a little complacent with their adherence to social distancing requirements. Once that infection kind of got, I suppose, entrenched in the population, just because of the way their culture is set up, where you have, you know, older generations living with younger generations.
Oh, yeah.
They were exposed to, obviously, high-risk patients were exposed to infection.
The big Italian family unit, if you like, then, that we see in the movies all of the time, that's still living there. That's how they interact. Their social interaction will be, one big, huge, happy family of all generations coming together.
Exactly, Neil. Yeah, and I think you've seen that play out in China. They would have a very similar kind of, family unit, where you'd have grandparents looking after children, their grandchildren. And we saw similar family clustering.
You know, when you talk of China, I know you spend some time there. Do you actually think that the Chinese figure for 3,261 deaths is the truth?
I don't necessarily think you need to say it as the truth, as in I think that's what their data is. It's accurate data, but there might have been underreporting, and I think that's inherent in any system. I mean, if you were to take Ireland's data today, if you think that our current number of infected is 1,000, I think that would be very naive. You could probably put a multiple of 10 on that if you wanted to consider, just purely based on our testing capacities, we're probably missing a lot of people. So I wouldn't say there's any purpose, you know, they're not trying to change the data to make it look good or anything. I think there's, underreporting is inherent part of the problem.
Okay, but you're suggesting that our figure is more likely to be now 10,000, is it?
I don't think it's likely. I think it's almost definite. I think if you look at the mathematical, empirical data that we're looking from Italy, South Korea, the numbers that are being reported are always far below the actual numbers.
So what's going to make a difference here, do you think, Paul, particularly with what regards, say, we saw yesterday?
I honestly think, given our capacities, the thing that is most within our power to do is social distancing and compliance with those basic things that the HSE are telling us to do. I would say lockdown is a good idea, but we haven't really defined what lockdown means. I would really like to get a very clear idea of, the timeline and how it will affect numbers and stuff like that. But in the short term, I think it's certainly something we need to be considering, just to buy us some time to build key capacities.
That lockdown could come then, you think, particularly with what we saw yesterday. And also the Minister Harris was also very critical of not all supermarkets, but some who haven't got on board with regards to physically distancing customers. It could come that all non-essential people wouldn't work. Is that the way it would play out here, that you'd have only maybe medics, doctors, the army, the guards, people who were involved in the food supply chain, only those?
Yeah, I think the term they use is non-essential business will be halted, and I think it's an inevitable step. I think we're just waiting to see when the best time to pull that trigger is, but I think looking at Europe and the rest of the world, it's inevitable.
Because the UK this morning, Sky News are reporting an A&E consultant saying that it's possibly days until the British hospitals hit capacity and what's coming will be extremely big. You don't think that's a headline grabber? It's the truth, do you?
I think, of course, it's the truth. Look, there's ample models we can use to kind of substantiate or corroborate that claim.
So what can the public be doing then? Is it fair to say that at this stage they can't even go for a walk?
No, I think walks, it's purely social distancing. If you adhere to those, basic tenets, then a walk is fine. There's no evidence to say that this is, genuinely an airborne illness where it's going to be flying around in the air or anything like that. It's just purely, if you're in proximity to someone who's infected, that's when your risk is high. If you're not in proximity to someone who's infected, then you're very safe. Yeah.
Okay, hold on there, say if you will, because I just want to bring Nick back in again. Are you getting lots of calls then, Nick, with regards to people making queries to mygp.ie? Is that the case? And would all of them have, would you say they're all genuine concerns?
Yes, look, we're getting an awful lot of calls. I mean, if you take it that maybe 2 weeks ago, before it really became into the public consciousness, we had, I think, 1,750 calls to the practice. Then the week before last, we haven't last year's figures, but the week before Paddy's, that was gone up to 3,600, so over 100% increase in calls. And look, in fairness, people are worried, and I can tell this morning already from messages that I'm getting from patients and from requests I have from callbacks that concern is augmenting. So I think that the message for, as Paul has said there, the message for the public is, look, follow the advice, play the cards that we have in our hands, and that gives us the best chance of being personally safe, but also of stopping the spread. And you spoke with Paul there about lockdown, and Paul quite rightly said, look, we have to define what lockdown will mean for society in Ireland. And Simon Harris has hinted there are more stringent social restrictions in the future. But if I just go back to the quote from Mike Ryan from last week, he's an Irishman working with WHO, an expert in disease outbreaks. perfect. He said, be fast, have no regrets. If you need to be right before you move, you will never win. Perfection is the enemy of the good. Speed trumps perfection. Everyone is afraid of the consequences of error, but the greatest error is not to move. And then if you just make a slight change in the wording of that, and lockdown is what we're doing, and again, that has to be defined, but lockdown fast, have no regrets. If you need to be right before you lock down, you will never win. Perfection is the enemy of the good. Speed trumps perfection. Everyone is afraid of the consequences of error, but the greatest error is not to move to lockdown.
Okay, no. Pick up on that, Dr. Paul, if you will, that the medics in Ireland seem to be calling, or at least you guys are, for a total lockdown at this stage. Am I right?
Yes, look, it's, as I think the quote that Nick used is very, very succinct here. It's exactly what we need to be considering. Again, I would just really worry about what lockdown will look like in this country. So I think we do need some discussion on that before we pull the trigger. But as I said, I think we're looking at a week before the government pulls the trigger on it. So I think we best prepare for it and decide on the best methods and the length of time we're going to do it for and have some transparency in terms of our national dialogue on it.
And what length of time do you think that would be, Paul, for it to be of benefit? Are we talking about a lockdown for a fortnight, a month, or what?
I would have no ability to comment on that, Neil. That's something for the government to be considering.
But with regards to, say, the virus itself, what does it need?
Look, we already know a lot about the transmission dynamics and how it manifests clinically. So, I mean, we know it has an incubation period of 1 to 2 weeks. And then we know that, you know, symptomatically you might be having an infection for another 1 to 2 weeks. So, I mean, I think if we look at China, they saw good figures in terms of the lockdown translating to a reduction in new cases and a reduction in, you know, spread in about 1 month. So I think maybe that's what we're looking at. But again, I think we have to, you know, look at the China model with a bit of, you know, incredulity, because we have huge capacity differences between Ireland and China.
Okay, I also observed that nearly 160 of the positive cases in the Republic are health staff. So obviously they've been taken out of, you know, they can't go to work and stuff. Obviously, there's issues as well, critical of a lack of masks, a lack of gowns for you know, healthcare workers. That's unfortunate, isn't it?
Yeah, look, we actually have data on that as well. They showed in Wuhan that if the medical staff were adequately equipped with the protective equipment, there was actually no cases of infection in healthcare staff. And then they were in the highest risk group as well. The patients are the doctors that were treating patients with confirmed infections that were doing, you know, invasive procedures. They had no infections, whereas people in lower risk scenarios that were doing, you know, some kind of elective procedures, they were actually getting increased rates of hospital infection if they didn't have adequate protective equipment.
So that means you're saying that our health staff are getting infected because of a shortage of protection?
I don't know. Look, I don't know if it's a shortage of protection, or maybe they're not fully versed in how to use it, or maybe that certain high-risk doctors or nurses aren't getting the right level of protection. It's hard to say.
Nick, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, Paul, I didn't mean to cut across you. I think if you look at the rates of healthcare professional infection, and Paul might correct me on the figures from China, but I think it was around 3.4% of infections were in healthcare professionals, whereas in Italy it's over 8. So I think it's certainly something, and as Paul has rightly alluded to there, it's likely to be multifactorial, but it's the availability of personal protective equipment, it's the training and putting it on, and importantly taking it off, but also, like, I mean, it's the protocols, and as Paul has alluded to there, well, of course the high risk staff need to be protected.
Yeah, but it seems that 15% of those that have been affected and have tested positive are healthcare staff. That's very high.
Yeah. It is very high. That would be, if that figure pans out to be our figure over the coming weeks.
Okay.
The system will be under significant pressure.
Okay. Just for both of you, because I appreciate you're both under pressure. But I'm getting an awful lot of stuff from overseas and people saying we need to wear masks. All of us need to wear masks. Pick up on that, if you will, Paul.
Well, look, Neil, it's not a matter of everyone needs to wear masks. I think we have to also be cognizant of our supply, what's available, and we need to, I suppose, shape our guidelines around that. Look, if everyone adheres to social distancing, masks are not a requirement. That's a fact. If you are not adhering to social distancing and you're exposing yourself to risk in terms of, you know, being in close proximity to infected people, I think it's just common sense that a mask is going to protect you. I mean, if they didn't, the doctors wouldn't be using them and nurses wouldn't have to use them. So I think, look, I'd still go with the point that if we have a limited supply in this country, it's most important that our frontline staff are the ones getting them and that, you know, the public aren't panicking and thinking they need to have masks. So social distancing, number one. And that's what I'd be going
okay,
to.
And, you know, I see people out there who are using scarves around their mouth and nose and others are pulling up their jumpers. Is that effective?
I haven't seen any evidence on that or any scientific data on it, Neil.
Okay. And do you believe that maybe something will be learned and we eventually will get the wake-up call needed because of what we saw all over the country in our beaches and our public parks yesterday?
I hope that the lesson we get isn't in terms of, you know, bad outcomes. I'd hope that finally we can look to countries that, you know, are struggling with COVID-19 and just say, look, draw a line in the sand and everyone complies with the requirements and the advice from the HSE.
Okay, hopefully I'll have an opportunity to stay in touch with you both in the coming days and weeks ahead. Thank you to Dr. Paul O'Brien and thank you also to Dr. Nick Flynn. Lines open 1850 104 106. I hope and endeavour